You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
This week's podcast, we are taking a look at the top prospects in each organization. I am Allison Footer from MLB.com. And, of course, some of these players we actually have heard a lot about, like the Mets left-hander Steven Matz, who made his debut in 2015 and actually pitched in the postseason. And then there are other players that haven't reached the big leagues but are very high profile, like for the Braves, the shortstop Dansby Swanson, who was a number one overall draft pick just a year ago. So it'll be interesting to keep our eye on these players and all of the players coming up through the NL East. I have Wayne Rondazzo here, who is a broadcaster for the Mets, pinch hitting again for Anthony DiComo. So let's move on. So I was kind of chuckling to myself looking at the Mets top prospects. The number one prospect would be somebody who a lot of us don't consider a prospect anymore, because it's left-hander Steven Matz, who we were introduced to last year when he made his major league debut. But this is pretty cool to see Matz finally coming into his own. He has had a long road, was a second-round pick of the Mets in 2009, and then he had Tommy John surgery and other issues. So he really showed a lot from just the short amount of time that he pitched for the Mets last year that he's probably going to be a mainstay in that rotation.
Yeah, that's the plan. I think in a lot of ways, too, when you look at some of these prospect lists, you do see guys make September call-ups or make a handful of appearances in the big leagues and then rightfully are the number one prospect coming back the next season. In Matz's case, only four or five starts in the regular season at the major league level, but he also made a couple of postseason starts. So he's probably a little bit more seasoned than most rookies coming into the next year because of what he got to experience in October. So I think that was great for him to be on the mound against the Dodgers, to pitch against the Cubs, and to be in the World Series. I think it was just a fantastic thing for Matz in his development to really be out there with the others, with Harvey and DeGrom and Syndergaard, and get to show what he can do on a national stage as well, with now under 10 major league appearances under his belt.
Yeah, no doubt. I think that is such an invaluable experience to just have that, and it can help so much down the road. And it's pretty cool because, if I'm not mistaken, he grew up a Mets, not just a Mets fan, but like a fanatic, like his whole family, correct? This is like a life.
Yeah, the whole family. Yeah. He grew up on Long Island, and the whole family full of Mets fans. And, you know, it was funny as he got to go through that experience last year. He said he kind of remembered the 2000 World Series. Can I show you how young Matz is? That he just the 2000 World Series is a vague remembrance. But, you know, he said that it really meant more to his family for him to be wearing that uniform and to see him in the World Series pitching for the Mets. And then it really did for him. It seemed like, you know, he was kind of just trying to be as professional as possible while he knew his family was sitting back and enjoying it.
So he'll probably be asking for some extra Piazza bobbleheads on the Sunday weekend that they're celebrating.
Yeah, exactly. And when the 86 Mets come out, the Mets will have no idea who those people are. So it'll be a learning experience, too, for him as they celebrate that team.
Okay, so let's get to the number two prospect. Outfielder Brandon, is it Nimmo or Nemo?
It's Nemo.
Nemo, okay. So his ETA is actually this upcoming season. He'll be 23 years old in March. An outfielder, first round pick by the team in 2011. So it looks like the thing that stuck out to me when I was reading his scouting report was how much he cut down in his strikeouts, going from AA to AAA. Which shows that he's got good kind of patience at the plate, which is a very good sign for a young hitter. That's probably the hardest thing to really develop from a coaching standpoint is just that kind of patience. So that's pretty encouraging, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot they like about Brandon Nimmo, and I think at the end of the day, Sandy Alderson feels that the fact that he's already an on-base percentage heavy type player is something that, you know, as Sandy Alderson and Sabermetrics and Moneyball, we all know how valuable getting on base is, and to those, especially to an executive like Sandy Alderson. So you see Nimmo's on base percentage routinely above 350, even into 380 for his career in the minor leagues, and that's already something that he'll bring to the table coming up to the big leagues, presumably in the next year or two. I would imagine you'll see Nimmo at some point in 2016 at the major league level, and then really start to find his way up near the 2017 season. So it's still maybe a year away, but I think the Mets feel like they had some room to work with Nimmo, that he was a young guy that hadn't played a ton of baseball when it comes to especially against severe competition. You know, he played baseball in high school in Wyoming, which didn't have, there is no high school baseball in Wyoming. So he had to play American Legion ball and all that. So he's really still kind of developing his skills as a baseball player, and the Mets seem happy with what he's done so far.
Bill, we're going to talk about the prospects in a second, but I also want to talk about a little news that you're working on, more of a feature story, but about Tim Raines. Of course, we've had the Hall of Fame announcement was a couple weeks ago, and the discussions that follow that, and overwhelmingly, Tim Raines is believed to be not a shoo-in, but has a pretty good chance next year of getting in. So I guess you'd look a little bit more into that. What can you tell us about that?
Yes, I spoke to Tim Raines last week, and what's interesting is he likes his chances. He knows it's really his last chance, his 10th and final chance, and he really likes his chances. And I think finally he'll be the third Expo to go in the Hall of Fame, and you can't forget Vladdy as well. So him and Vladdy could go in all at once next year. So it'll be good to see.
And so, really, I feel like Tim Raines sort of gets lost in the shuffle a little bit. Obviously, his final year of eligibility coming up, so a lot of people have left him off their ballots. But in terms of, like, somebody, I think it was Ken Rosenthal said, if there was no Ricky Henderson, we'd be talking about Tim Raines being the greatest of all time, being the greatest base stealer, one of the fastest runners in baseball. I mean, all of the things that, you know, his numbers kind of speak for themselves, as they say. But pretty amazing that he's still not getting as much support as you would think that he should.
It's funny you mention this, Allison, because I asked Tim Raines why all of a sudden people are realizing what he did. And he really believes that technology and research from the writers is the reason people realizing what he's doing, what he did, I should say. And, you know, when he was with the Montreal Expos, it was rare that they were on the game of the week. He feels that that the writers now are finally doing their research on him, realizing he wasn't that bad. You know, you should check his on-base percentage. It's really high. And not just with the Expos, but if you look at him as a bench player with the Yankees, it's like .395 or better. I mean, he was really a good hitter and not a bad outfielder either. And this was a guy who was supposed to be, quote-unquote, the next Joe Morgan, and it didn't work out that way, but trying to be a great outfielder, though.
Yeah, I think next year we could see Tim Raines and Jeff Bagwell get inducted, which would be pretty cool, so we'll keep our eye on that. Let's move on to the top prospects, of course, in the Nationals organization. So the number one prospect being a right-hander, Lucas Giolito. It says on our MLB pipeline coverage, which is very thorough and extensive and accurate, I believe, his ETA is 2016. We could possibly see him up this year. 21 years old, so he's had a long road. I guess it would be nice to see everything kind of come together for him this season.
Oh, no question. I mean, this is a guy who had Tommy John surgery in 2012, and he's fully recovered. There aren't any limits on him. You know, I spoke to him a few weeks ago, and he's really prepared for spring training. He's going to be joining the Nationals this year. And hopefully during spring training, he will really show them he belongs in the rotation. And I'm expecting big things from him. There's no question in my mind about that.
Yeah, so he didn't pitch a full pro season until 2014, as you said. He had the Tommy John surgery. He played in the Futures game, which is always – there's a – like, the success rate of guys who play in the Futures game to actually get into the big leagues is, like, some 80% plus, which is pretty amazing.
Right.
And so let's look at his qualifications here. So he's got a mid to upper 90s fastball, touched 100, a 12-6 curveball, which is nearly as good as his fastball. So that's got to be nice to have a secondary pitch that's that good. And then and then he seems to be making progress with a changeup, which is always kind of a crucial thing to decide if the guy's going to be a starting pitcher. So it looks like all the tools are there. It's just a matter of putting it together.
Oh, no doubt. And let me tell you, Allison, you know, when I spoke to him, he said, I think the key for his season will be the changeup, because if he has the changeup, he will be successful in the mound. He said he can throw the changeup at any count, and that's the key. I mean, he did it a lot last year, and if he can throw that changeup 2-0, 3-1, and then throw strikes for it, he's going to be dangerous. And I'm expecting him to be one of the starters. I know he hasn't played yet, but I'm predicting he'll be one of the starters in 2016.
Yeah, they have to feel pretty good. I mean, not to get too far off the topic, but going in 2016, we talked about this a little bit last time, but the fact that this is still a hugely talented team, and they have, you know, everyone talks about the Mets starting pitching depth, which is, like, amazing. Like, they're starting four in the big league. But the Nationals, they have always been consistently deep in pitching, and they have to feel pretty good when they have, you know, like Giolito and those caliber guys coming up, that it gives them such a cushion in case something happens to their other regular starters.
Oh, there's no question about it. I mean, you saw it. They let Jordan Zimmermann go. I mean, they really feel that Joe Ross will be in that rotation as well. So, I mean, yes, they are really deep when it comes to their pitching. I think the biggest need, big time, will be getting some left-handed bats in the minor league system and improve their hitting overall, because they haven't really, since Bryce Harper, they really haven't had, or even Rendon, they haven't really had a good hitter come up through the minors in a while. So hopefully that will happen soon.
Mark, this is no big shock who we're about to talk about. It seems to be a pretty fluid situation when it comes to the Braves organization, but these are very exciting things for fans to sort of look at. So obviously the number one prospect in the Braves organization is Dansby Swanson, shortstop. His ETA is 2018. Can we move that up a bit? What do you think?
I think that's possible. I mean, basically what we're looking at is, you know, a kid who, you look at the numbers, he's only played 27 games at the pro level, with throw some playoff games in there last year. They're at the Class A level. But you know what? I've talked to enough guys, and I'm pretty comfortable with saying that the SEC, where, you know, obviously Vanderbilt had plenty of success during his years there, it is basically A-ball. So, I mean, I think if he does start the year at A-ball this year at Carolina, that's just basically, hey, look, we're not going to put any pressure on you. Maybe move him up to Double-A quickly. And then if he has some success, I expect next year, if we're doing this podcast around the same time next year, I think we'll be talking about, you know, is Swanson going to be the starting shortstop this year? You know, maybe they will have had another guy, but I think they'll go to camp next year with just at least that storyline alive that, hey, look, maybe he could start the year in Atlanta. You know, he's a very polished shortstop, very mature kid. Hometown kid, it'd be a great story to have him open up his major league career in this new stadium, which is located probably about 10 miles from where he went to high school. So I'm not putting that to rest yet. I know some people, it's safe to say 2018, but I still think there's a chance he starts the year, or maybe starts the year in Atlanta, but definitely gets up to Atlanta at some point in 2017.
Yeah, I think like one of those midseason promotions, you can kind of keep your eye on that. I mean, he's going to be 22 on February 11th, so of course he's a college player, which is why he's a little bit older, but and the number one pick by the Diamondbacks just last year, and obviously came over in that big blockbuster Shelby Miller trade. So he moved from second base to shortstop for his junior season, and he basically showed everyone he could stay, and that's really very telling. The fact that, you know, when you draft a shortstop, the first question everyone says is, can he stay there? And so there's really no doubt that this kid is going to be able to be a shortstop through his entire career.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's basically what the scouts say, is that it's pretty safe to project him to stay at the shortstop position. The Braves will have a decision to be made, because they do have Ozzie Albies, a young prospect. I think he ranks third or fourth on our list of prospects. He was number one before Newcomb and Swanson showed up here this offseason. He's an exciting young player. He can play shortstop. His arm strength is not quite the same as Swanson's. I think their range is similar. I think that they basically, the easy projection right now is that Swanson will stay at short and Albies makes the transition to second base at some point in time.
It sounds Johnson is a top of the lineup kind of guy, great on base ability, speed, and I guess they're just waiting to see if he can hit for power. And the only thing you can do is really wait that out, see how he does as he ascends to the minor leagues.
Yeah, and you know, it's I think, you know, a lot of what we know about Dansby Swanson, like I said, we've only got a handful of games here at the pro level to evaluate. We've seen him rise to the occasion with an aluminum bat, you know, the last couple of years at in Omaha there with Vanderbilt. But he's, you know, I think that maybe he's the kind of guy where you're looking at 290, 300 type hitter with 12 to 17 homer type, you know, range. He's not. I don't think he's going to be an overwhelmingly, you know, a power will not be his greatest asset, especially during the earliest year. Now, whether that maybe as the years go and he maybe develops a little bit more, but I don't think we should project him that way this early in his career.
So there's another guy who's actually number one before the Braves acquired Swanson in that trade, and that was left-hander Sean Newcomb, who came over from the Angels in the Andrelton Simmons trade. So this guy is big and strong, and his ETA is actually 2017, the Angels' first-rounder in 2014. And so that's got to be, I mean, anytime you can have a left-handed pitcher who throws that hard, that is just a gift. I can imagine the Braves were very excited when they finished this transaction.
Yeah, I mean, you know, here we are talking about these two guys at the end of last season. We were talking about how much the Braves had improved their farm system. And with these two trades, you go ahead and you start off the offseason, you trade Anderson Simmons, and you get Sean Newcomb. You know, he's a 19th ranked overall prospect with MLB.com's 19th overall prospect, and Swanson is number 10, I believe. So all of a sudden, you were happy about this farm system before. Now you added these two guys, and not only are they one of the game's, you know, two of the game's top prospects, but as you said with Newcomb, he's not far away. You know, if he starts to throw strikes more consistently, it won't be long before he's up. I think he could be up certainly at some point after that magical second week of June that prospects seem to always have to eclipse that line, right?
Right.
But, you know, I think by the end of the year we'll definitely see him. The control has been the issue. If he starts to throw strikes a little bit more consistently, as you mentioned, he has those weapons. You know, it's you don't see lefties like that. I've seen heard some comps to John Lester, and you know, we'll see as once he gets into camp, we'll get more of a look at him and have a better idea of not only who to best compare him to, or who to better compare him to, but also when he might reach Atlanta. So. But yeah, it's going to be exciting this year with Newcomb, because he could get there. Chris Ellis, the other pitcher they got in that same deal, where Anderson Simmons went to Anaheim, he could come this year, and maybe Lucas Sims at some point in time. And Aaron Blair, one of the other pitchers that they got with Swanson from Arizona.
Now with the Marlins, we have a couple of things. First of all, let's bring in Joe Fusaro, who covers the Marlins on an everyday basis. I'm Allison Cutter. Joe, this is what we hear sometimes when a team, a couple of years after opening a new ballpark, and then we'll hear that they've made some adjustments to the ballpark to better fit the team. And it appears the Marlins have done just that. So why don't you talk about what they've done with those fences in the outfield?
Yeah, listen, this will be, believe it or not, year five of the Marlins at Marlins Park. They moved in 2012, and it was kind of clear, at least from a hitter's standpoint, people around the club, you know, just how difficult it was to hit the ball out of this ballpark. Very spacious, especially the middle of the field, and being at sea level, the ball doesn't carry well here anyway. So they started construction early this month on moving the fences in. And on Monday, the Marlins gave the media a tour of the progress. And everything's going well, and the area most affected will be center field, basically going from the left field gap all the way over to the right field. And in dead center, where the sign is 418, it's moving to 407, so it'll be 11 feet difference there. And equally as important, they're lowering the fences as well. They've been 11 and a half feet high down the, you know, basically left field foul pole to the gap
right field foul pole to the gap. That's going down to 7 feet. So for the first time ever, you're going to see the ability of an outfielder to, you know, make a nice leaping play and perhaps rob a home run or certainly extra bases at the wall. So, you know, these changes, you know, Allison, the season where the Marlins, you know, kind of made it clear they weren't going to spend a big boatload of money on free agents, and they kind of made it also clear that the resources they have were going to be allocated to pitching. And we saw that with the Wei-Yin Chen signing and some other signings. You know, Chris Johnson is the only 40-man roster move that this team has made position player-wise, and he is basically just a platoon depth at first and depth at third base. So these moves in terms of moving offenses are probably, you know, probably will go down as the biggest move of the offseason the organization's making to improve offensive productivity. Be obviously interesting to see how it plays, you know, other parks like Citi Field, New York, Safeco, and Petco out west in Seattle and San Diego. They moved him in a few years ago as well. The Marlins are following suit.
And it didn't seem like it was that expensive, if I was reading your coverage correctly. It's just about $500,000, which is, of course, a lot of money. But in this perspective, it's really not that much, right?
Yeah, it's $500,000 when you get down to it. What's the cost of a minimum, you know, salaried player is, might be like $510,000 this year. So, you know, you could basically look at if it brings production of, you know, keep in mind, the Marlins love their young outfield. Stanton obviously hits home runs everywhere. But, you know, Marcelo Zuna in center, Christian Yelich in left, these are two really promising young hitting talents. And Yelich had 7 home runs last year, just 1 at home. Ozuna had 10, just 2 at home. So I think in 3 years, Yelich has 3 home runs at Marlins Park. Now, you know, there are other things, factors to his game. He doesn't hit the ball in the air particularly often. But part of that might also be just you're not rewarded for driving the ball in the gaps at Marlins Park. So it's going to be really interesting to see, you know, guys like that. You know, to have 2 high-caliber players combining for 3 home runs at home kind of magnified the need to make this change.
Yes, I would say so. You certainly don't want your stars getting discouraged and letting it get in their heads, and then that can have residual effects too. So I would imagine that everyone will be happy with that. So let's move on to talk about a couple of top prospects in the Marlins organization. I love talking about the Marlins' number one prospect, Tyler Colick, basically because back in my days with the Astros, there was this kid is obviously a very hard-throwing Texas right-hander, and there was a hard-throwing Texan front office member with the Astros. His name is Nolan Ryan, who really wanted the Astros to take this kid. And they passed on him, and so the Marlins got him. So it looks like that might have been a good thing for the Marlins.
Yeah, he was a number 2 overall pick, and as you noted, Allison, number 2 overall pick in 2014. I think I got it right. It was 14, right?
Yeah,
2 years ago. And, you know, as you noted, Nolan Ryan went and saw this kid and really, really liked him. And, you know, I think to record the 102-mile-an-hour fastball was the highest clock ever by a high school player. Now, you know, it's been a little bit of tough sledding for Tyler since he's become a pro. Very much still a raw talent with, you know, big upside. And, you know, this is a kid who isn't throwing as hard, probably because he's probably more focused on mechanics. And he's one of the reasons why they made some changes in their developmental staff. And they got Jim Benedict to kind of be the vice president coordinating pitching. They got him from the Pirates organization. And, you know, working with Colick, I imagine, is going to be real, real high priority for Jim Benedict as well as the developmental staff, because there's just way too much raw talent here to let go to waste. Now, keep in mind, Tyler still, he's just 20 years old, needs to kind of refine to Allison. He's got to get that secondary pitches. The breaking ball has to come along to complement and get people off the fastball. And, you know, I think just, you know, with tinkering with some mechanics and getting him right, he's going to be an interesting guy to see in spring training to see if Tyler kind of takes it to the next level. He also is probably projecting to go to Class A Jupiter, Advanced Class A, for the first time in a Florida State League, a pitcher's league. So it'll be real interesting to see how he does. But, you know, if here's a guy who should be a top-of-the-rotation caliber guy, and keep in mind the Marlins, you know, pretty much looking at 3 years probably maximum of Jose Fernandez, assuming that, you know, he plays it out and they trade him if they can't sign him long term. And by then, they think they would hope that in the next year or two, Kolek will emerge as that frontline caliber starter to, if they were to lose Jose in a couple of years, you would at least have an internal ace that was a top of the, draft class to step in.
Todd, before we start talking about these top prospects, let's talk about a little bit of news that came out from Phillies camp today, and that they signed David Lowe to a minor league contract. So what do you know? He's a little bit older. Looks like he's a little experienced. What do you know about him?
Yeah, you know, David Lowe essentially is a guy that's going to be in camp to provide a little bit of depth for the organization. Just a couple weeks ago, we talked to Pete McCann, and he was talking about the competition in the outfield. But really, when you look at it going into spring training, there's five, I would say, I won't say locks, but as close to the locks as you can get. You have Odubel Herrera, Peter Borges, Aaron Altherr, Cody Asche, and Tyler Goodell, the Rule 5 pick. Those five guys have excellent chances of making the team going into the season. But after that, they really don't have a lot of depth, and that's kind of where David Lowe comes into play. He's got some big league experience, parts of four seasons in the big leagues, a little less than 750 career plate appearances, and he's just going to, he's going to spell some of these guys in camp, and then unless there's an injury or two or somebody doesn't perform as expected in spring training, I think he'll probably open the season in AAA and be ready for a call-up if one arises during the season.
Yeah, these are transactions that don't get a lot of attention from fans or get a lot of play from us in the media, but these are the kinds of players that do make a season go around. Filling up 6 months of a baseball season, 162 games, there are injuries, little ouchies here and there. And these guys kind of, they are, like you said, they'll probably start at AAA, but they're just so versatile. They can come up and down and just kind of fill in when they're needed.
Yeah, Phillies have a lot of, it seems like at this point, at this time of year, you have almost every team is signing veterans to minor league contracts, and those players know that, you know what, I don't have a great shot at making the team, but there's a very good chance that they'll be up at some point. You know, maybe you never know. He could be up for 2 or 3 months. He could be up in September. You know, it's tough to say, but yeah, these types of moves, they don't get a lot of attention, but, you know, Emmanuel Burris is on a minor league invite to spring training. Guys like that, you might see at some point.
Okay, so let's move on to the complete opposite end of the spectrum, which would be young prospects who we expect to have nice, long, illustrious major league careers. Of course, who really knows how that's going to work out, but let's talk about the Phillies' number one prospect, J.P. Crawford. So his ETA is actually 2016. He's 21 years old. Just turned 21.
Right.
So very young guy. The 15th overall pick in 2013. So he is moving quickly. Reached Double A by age 20. So that has to be a good sign that he's on a good track.
Yeah, it is. They love him. People around baseball love him. He's got a ton of talent, and you know he was in the top 10 MLB pipeline last year, and I just wrote today, making the argument, could he be the number one prospect in baseball? He probably is not the number one prospect in baseball, but he does a lot of things really well that at least he enters the conversation. Certainly, if you're among the top 10 prospects in baseball, you're in the conversation. But he has done a lot of things right, and the Phillies still think there's a lot more in him in terms of development and potential. And they look at him as a guy who can be a perennial all-star at shortstop.
So he was always kind of the Rollins heir apparent, and now that Jimmy Rollins has cleared the path. So he should be ready soon, and it looks like he would be like kind of a top of the lineup kind of guy, a good base stealer, very quick. Do I have that right?
Yeah, they think that the Phillies think that he's got the potential to hit 290, 300, steal 15 to 20 bases. They think his power will improve. I don't know if he's a 20 home run guy, but I think 10 to 15 certainly is possible. But hey, way back in the day, nobody thought Jimmy Rollins would have a lot of power, and he ended up popping 30 a couple times. So, but a high average, a little bit of speed, a little bit of power, and I think what's impressed a lot of people, and this is where the analytics guys really love him, is you look at his career stats in the minor leagues, and he's walked 160 times and he struck out 163. So, you know, in this day and age, it seems, you know, you've got guys in there coming up through the system, they'll walk 20 times and they'll strike out 140, and you kind of hope that they figure out. The Phillies have certainly had some of those prospects the past several years, but he's at the opposite end where he recognizes the strike zone, and, you know, he knows how to take a walk, he knows how to work a count, he knows how to recognize pitches, and that's, I think, the thing where the Phillies farm system folks, they say, boy, he's really going to get better, because if he's doing this in the minor leagues with just a couple of years experience, wait till he gets a little bit more experience. His numbers should get even better.
So you could see him reasonably earning a call up at some point in 2016, if not making the team right out of spring training, like in 2017.
Yes, I absolutely do. You know, Freddie Galvis right now is the shortstop, but Crawford clearly is. He's coming, and if he continues to play well and develop like they expect, he's really going to be pushing Freddie Galvis. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, because they have Cesar Hernandez at second base right now, and Freddie Galvis is considered probably a better defensive player than Cesar Hernandez. So now it creates a little bit more competition. You know, if J.P. Crawford starts the season in AAA, which I bet he will, And he plays really, really well, and the front office is like, we cannot keep this guy down there any longer. Now you're looking at Freddie Galvis, and now they're in a competition to play second base. So it's definitely a good thing, but, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if he's up maybe July 1st, maybe just after the trade deadline. Some point this summer, if he's playing well, I definitely would expect J.P. Crawford to be in the big leagues.